May is Fibromyalgia Awareness Month. It's important to raise awareness about this chronic and often debilitating invisible illness known as fibromyalgia. This month-long campaign is an opportunity to educate people about the symptoms, causes, and treatments of fibromyalgia, as well as to show support for those living with these and other related invisible illnesses. Through increased awareness, we can work towards better understanding and management of fibromyalgia and ultimately improve the quality of life for those who are affected by it. And now on to this week's episode. Have you ever heard of railway spine? What is railway spine and why is it important? Is there any relevance to understanding fibromyalgia and overlapping chronic pain conditions and related illnesses? The answer is yes. Back in the 1800s, as railroads were starting to become more and more common, so were accidents. Sometimes these were deadly, but some people had relatively minor injuries, but they had symptoms that were severe and long-lasting. These symptoms included pain, fatigue, cognitive difficulties of different types, and a lot of these symptoms overlap with chronic overlapping pain conditions like fibromyalgia and chronic regional pain syndromes. Doctors were left with a dilemma. Patients complained of these symptoms, but physical exam findings did not support a clear medical diagnosis. So what were physicians to do? How did they react? Well, some physicians reacted out of deep empathy and assumed that they had a real medical problem and tried to come up with different theories as to what was causing their persistent symptoms. On the other hand, there were people in the medical community that thought patients were faking this, that they were malingering, similar to what we find in the present. How do we know if somebody is just trying to use this for financial gain? Are they just trying to get out of work so they can get disability? Are they trying to sue somebody because they have chronic pain after a car accident? Or in that case, of course, in the railway accident. So much back then leads into the present. So let's hop on board as we go back in time to look at railway spine. In 1860, the journal Lancet pointed out greatly upon medical evidence that the money compensation for the injuries inflicted or alleged to be inflicted must be estimated. It demands all the resources which medical science can bring to the task to unravel the intricate questions that are continually arising in connection with this subject. So what they were recognizing back then is that people who were having injuries while on the railroad were suing the companies, and they were, as we will say, not having the typical proof of an injury, yet they were complaining of suffering, and if and how much compensation should they receive. They were trying to get all of the resources because something mysterious was happening. It's almost like some pandemic or some mystery lesion was happening, and maybe there's something they were missing. Why would people be suffering? There has to be some cause to this. So what were the symptoms of railway spine? The post-accidents were noted to be usually nervous in character, and that afflicted apparently uninjured railway passengers, attracting increasingly greater attention. Individuals escaped from accidents unhurt or with only superficial injuries. Some of these accidents, people actually were killed. Some of them were highly traumatic. Yet most who had what we would consider relatively minor injuries. But some of them subsequently developed worsening nervous complaints over a period of weeks or months. The symptoms that were described in the Journal of Medicine, Lancet, back in the 1800s, cited cases of people with symptoms of disturbed and diminished sleep, frequently starting, as they would call it, when dozing, which we would probably say flinching or movement or potentially kicking. Those are very similar to what we would call restless leg syndrome and periodic limb movement disorder, which we've discussed previously on prior episodes. But a quick review is those symptoms are an uncomfortable sensation in the legs with them. Described in different ways, like tingling, creepy, crawly, achy. Hard to get comfortable. That gradually gets worse as time goes on, with an irresistible urge to have to move or stretch the toes or ankles and roll them, and with either partial or complete improvement in symptoms, at least temporarily, but usually comes back once the legs stop moving. And most people who have this continue to have movement throughout the night, known as periodic limb movement disorder. Other symptoms included the following: horrific dreams of collision. They reported tinnitus, feverishness.
Many people with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia can relate to that because it often feels like they're coming down with the flu or that they have influenza, but unfortunately it's been going on for months and years and hasn't gotten any better.
They reported a feeble pulse, which it's hard to say if they were actually measuring the strength of the pulse, but the self-perception was that they didn't have that energy, like by referencing the feeble pulse, that they might be what many people with POTS syndrome refer to as lightheadedness or dizziness. They also were noted to be much paler, which again may be this sense of lack of vitality. Other symptoms included tingling and numbness of the extremities, local paralysis, paraplegia, functional lesions of the kidney and bladder, and even ensuing symptoms of intellectual derangement. Now, when we look at numbness and tingling, that's very common in people who have fibromyalgia. One of the key differentiators between fibromyalgia and something like multiple sclerosis or a other more classic organic lesion is that even though somebody may feel that there is some tingling or numbness of the extremities,
because of that, we have to be very alert as physicians for uncommon or even rare diagnoses like neuritis, such as Wegener's granulomatosis, which can cause inflammation and pain in the extremities. But the difference is often there will be clear exam findings of deficits like lack of sensation to vibration or to touch, possibly diminished reflexes or asymmetry.
We also will do careful evaluation to look at strength. Usually a careful examination is going to show what we would classically call an organic problem like multiple sclerosis or a stroke or dermatomyositis or other inflammatory type condition based on a physical exam, and then if needed, appropriate testing such as MRI to evaluate for multiple sclerosis or stroke or other testing like SED rates and creatine kinase to assess for inflammation of the muscles or joints. Looking at local paralysis and paraplegia, if somebody literally did have local paralysis and paraplegia, I would be very worried that they had something more significant going on, and I'm not sure that meant they couldn't walk or couldn't lift their arms, because that would not be under the umbrella of a fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome type problem. What were functional lesions of the kidney and bladder? We would say that's similar to what we would call a chronic painful bladder syndrome, irritable bladder, and pain associated with urination, but they would not have seen anything on urine that looked abnormal. No blood in the urine, no abnormal color, nothing to suggest an infection. And then they talked about symptoms of intellectual derangement. Well, if that isn't a very curious or interesting way to describe brain fog. So many people who are living with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, as we've talked about many times on this podcast, will report brain fog. It's that cognitive fatigue that makes it extremely challenging to function and get through everyday life.
In addition, you may also have irritability, nervousness, feeling on edge, excessive anger, what we would often call emotional dysregulation. There can be decreased motivation, the sense of too much noise going on in their brain that they have to filter out, and which makes it much harder to function, to get everyday activities done, and can be very overwhelming. Speaking of noise, many people, when it's quiet, will have tinnitus or ringing in their ears. Now, that's not a problem for the majority of people, and it's a sign of hearing damage. But for those who have more of a nociceptive or central pain sensitization nervous system are more likely to experience this as distressful.
One victim of railway spine did not complain of any special injury at the time of collision, but the following day was forced to abandon his efforts to work normally on account of feeling of nervous depression. I think that would be a sense of just feeling overwhelmed. Again, that might be the acute stress of seeing a severe accident. He also struggled with having the faces of his fellow passengers with their terrified eyes coming before him when he attempted to do any reading or writing. Many such cases involved pain in the back and neck as well as severe headaches, suggesting that they would today maybe overlap with whiplash injury, but also looking at those terrified looks overlapping with PTSD and also potentially with migraines. They also use terms such as extreme emotionalism and unprovoked aggression.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I want to briefly interrupt the podcast to inform you about the Fibromyalgia Starter Pack, which is now available. If you are new to this podcast, it categorizes the episodes in a way that it's more beneficial for those new to fibromyalgia. You can access the link in the show notes to learn more.
Hyper-emotional arousal, that proclivity to have much more of a stronger emotional reaction to the temperature of the room or situation that they're going through. And then unprovoked aggression, that might be another way of saying anger and reacting on that. So that goes right along with that emotional hyper-arousal. You're upset, something doesn't go your way, and then the pause button, that filter, is thin, and then someone is more likely to quickly react to a situation again and then act on their frustration. There also was noted to be acute depression and personality changes, loss of sexual appetite or libido, and sensory disturbance. These cases were apparently quite common and went for about 60 years from 1860 until about 1920. And that's right around the time of the Great War. So what were the most common theories to the pathophysiology of these symptoms? At the time, they thought that there was some kind of physiological reason with that concussion to the spine that was causing the pain. The physicians at the time first approached the problem looking for an underlying physical injury to account for the symptoms. The difficulty, however, was that the lack of any injury of sufficient seriousness to explain the major disorders frequently associated with the condition. In 1866, John Erickson, professor of surgery at the University College Hospital in London, published a study in which he confronted this difficulty by suggesting that the physical injury involved was of a very insidious character consisting of chronic and subacute inflammation. Inflammatory reaction to the spinal membranes produced by the severe physical shock of the collision. He did admit, however, that the psychological circumstances of the accident would have a bearing on the subsequent disorder, noting that the helplessness of the sufferers and the natural perturbation of the mind, which must have been disturbed. The bravest are circumstances that have a necessity greatly increased the severity of the resulting injury to the nervous system. In a later 1875 edition of his book, Erickson was more explicit about the psychological aspect of the disorder, suggesting that the underlying physical condition could be the result of either mental or moral unconsciousness caused by the terror of the accident, producing a temporary breakdown in the brain's ability to control the nervous system. The mental or moral unconsciousness may occur without the infliction of any physical blow or direct violence to the head or spine. It's commonly in persons who have been exposed to comparatively trifling degrees of violence, who have suffered nothing more than a general shock or concussion of the system. It is probably dependent in great measure upon the nature of fear, according to Erickson.
We now understand that this is a genetic predisposition or something in their constitution that makes them more susceptible. Dr. Erickson thought there was some inflammation in the meninges or the supporting structure of the spinal cord in the brain that was causing these symptoms, but that there was a psychological overlay that affected it.
And he continues in talking about the nature of fear, emphasizing that the frantic terror felt by the railway accident victims caused the unique level of mental shock associated with these accidents. Although he continued to assert that insidious and chronic pathological condition of the spinal cord was in direct cause of the nervous disorders, other medical authorities went further than Erickson in suggesting that these psychological circumstances of the accident were not sufficient to bring about the condition. The prominent surgeon, Dr. Clark, for example, claimed that the protracted functional disturbance or even fatal disease can be the consequence of a rude shock. In 1883, a fully developed psychological theory of railway spine appeared in the work of surgeon Dr. Herbert Page, who saw the psychological effects of railway accident is quite compatible of inducing a subsequent nervous illness. When we, again, look at the term functional, it is a term that we often used in modern eras as things like a functional abdominal pain. There is no cancer or ulcer in the stomach. There is no celiac disease. There is no Crohn's. But there is pain and there is distress. The absorption of food is going properly. And back then, they thought that there was a psychological component. We now call these disorders of the gut-brain interaction. When you look at these two doctors, Dr. Erickson was accepting that fear had a role to play in increasing the severity of the order. He still saw the neuroses of the railway spine as a result of physical concussion injury. Dr. Page thought that the psychological influence of fear is the primary causative element bringing about the symptoms of the nervous system by provoking physiological changes, perhaps chemical in nature, in the nervous system. Again, the idea of chemistry was going on back then, and in the near future, the understanding of, on a very simple level, the electrical impulses going through nerves would be discovered. Interestingly, we now understand that there is a difference in perception, looking at functional MRIs, showing differences in how the brain is perceiving different impulses. And this involves parts of the brain that quickly interact with other parts of the brain that are involved in things like fear and memory. Dr. Page inverted Dr. Erickson's model of railway spine. For Erickson, the injury came first and caused the nerve symptoms. For Page, the psychological came first and produced the physical changes that underlay the subsequent disorder. The new psychological model of post-traumatic nervous disruption, Dr. Page employed the concept of general nervous shock, which he defined in terms of some functional disturbance of the whole nervous system. In a sense, the balance or the tone was felt to be off rather than any structural damage to any organ of the body. Now, when we look at that in a up-to-date understanding, I would look at it as more of a question of, is it a hardware problem that's in your computer or is it a software problem? And with fibromyalgia and other overlapping chronic pain conditions, it's more of the time a software problem where how somebody is processing the input and running the information and giving a output versus a hardware problem where the wiring is injured or broken or short-circuiting and not running properly, and that would be more of a classic organic cause such as inflammation or injury to a nerve, a tumor, etc. And again, the software problem is a difference in how the brain and spinal cord and brainstem are processing these. They are influenced by other factors that can turn this up and down. And we look at this as a volume control. Dr. Daniel Claw and others have used this to help understand this better. You can have a guitar plugged into an amplifier and all the different guitar strings are representing sensations such as smell, sight, sound, touch, distension of the in stomach. Interoception is awareness of internal sensations within the intestines. All of those can be affected by a volume control in one sense. And there are things that can turn up and down this volume control. And what that means is that when you have an input, and if the volume control is turned higher, if I strum my guitar string, you will have a higher sound that is experienced or heard in real life when we're thinking of a guitar. And if it's in the brain, and the sense of distress will be at a higher level. And you can have things that turned down this level of distress, just like turning down the volume control. There are many different inputs that can affect the distress level. Dr. Erickson had recognized a similarity between railway spine and traumatic hysteria, in strongly suggesting that there were forms of that same phenomenon, and that traumatic hysteria would be something that we would more likely call PTSD. The hysterical condition is essentially one in which there is loss of control and enfeeblement of the power of the will. Let some sudden, profound psychiatrical disturbance, such as may well be induced by the shock and terror of railway collisions, forthwith the intellectual control is lessened, while organic sensations declared their being and force themselves into the conscious life of the individual. This connection between the experience of a traumatic event and manifestation of seemingly hysterical nervous disorders looked forward to the work of Oppenheim, Charcot, and Freud, and indicated the direction in which the study of the traumatic neuroses was to go in the future. By the end of the 19th century, the role of psychological elements in provoking neuroses had very largely been accepted by the medical profession. The possibility of an ultimate organic cause could not be ruled out, however. Advances in neurology from the turn of the century led to the development of new organic theories, placing the disorder at the level of the nervous system rather than seeking, as had Erickson, to identify inflammation and lesion at the level of the muscle and nerve tissue. The term railway spine itself remained in use until the Great War as a kind of medical and legal shorthand for certain kinds of post-accident traumatic neuroses, although the particular character of the railway accident as a cause was no longer a significant issue. The final appearance of the phrase in the diagnostic models that it represented can be ascribed to two developments. First, the development of the Freudian and post-Freudian psychiatry. The investigation of traumatic neuroses moved from their possible neurological basis towards an abstract world of psychoanalytical theorizing, with psychiatry becoming increasingly divorced from the practice of clinical medicine. And second, the war itself saw the manifestation of traumatic neuroses and nervous shock in the dramatic view, new form of shell shock, a focus of medical and psychiatric debate and investigation that initially drew significantly on the discussions of railway spine and related conditions, but that very quickly made such earlier categories irrelevant.
Shortly before his death in 1896, an elderly and long since retired John Erickson took time to write a letter to Dr. Swearingen, who was a Texas physician and had defended Erickson against a series of ad hominem attacks appearing in a variety of publications. As an old man, Erickson expressed little desire to become engaged in what he termed surgical polemics, let alone to defend himself from any personal attacks. Instead, he preferred to reflect on the most hospitable and friendly reception he received from his surgical brethren in the United States during a visit some 20 years ago. But despite his statements to the contrary, Erickson could not resist the temptation to express himself one final time on the subject he had almost single-handedly created. He writes, "Nearly 30 years have passed since I have brought the subject of railway and other injuries of the nervous system to the notice of the profession. At that time, 1866, the pathology of the nervous system and injuries were very imperfectly understood, and even the nomenclature had not been invented. Neuroses and neurasthenia, even, were unknown terms, and what I then, for want of a better name, called concussion of the spine, is now universally recognized and described under the more modern appellation of traumatic neurasthenia. The morbid states are the same, and the symptoms identical, but the name has been changed, and the modern designation is probably more in accordance with modern views than was the older one. In all my writings on this subject, I have pointed out that symptoms arising from railway shocks are identical with those that occur from other and more ordinary accidents of civil life, and that these symptoms so occurring had been described by surgeons many years before railways were dreamt of, and fully a century before I had written a line on the subject. And that brings us up to a series I did on neurasthenia a year and a half ago. It's worth checking out as we continue this historical understanding. It also is interesting how, even though names change, the symptoms and people and the struggles didn't change. We have this central pain sensitization syndrome that's now changing to the nociceptive pain disorders, and fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome. All of these are similar names for the same kinds of problems. I got a chance in my pre-medical training program to take a course called Medical History. To me, it's fascinating, history in general, but medical history is extremely fascinating. I think more doctors should know about it. I think more people should know about it to help understand their disease and their illness better. When I consider what the doctors were challenged with, it is similar to our current struggle. People are trying to give a rationalization for what's going on. And for most people, they're not trying to get any legal compensation. They just want to function better and feel better. Unfortunately, a lot of people are still struggling, and I hope that this podcast has been helpful for you to help put some historical perspective. This is not anything new. These are similar conditions that have been going on for a long time. Scientists were giving hypotheses that didn't have the proper technology to test and prove their theories to be correct. The inflammation of the meninges may be thought of as irritation within the nervous system that we now know is called a neuroplastic nervous system. There are these superhighways which connect these experiences of distress to certain parts of the brain where the alarm center is going off, and then the experiences of anxiety and pain and overwhelm take over, with the control button stuck in the on position. We will finish out next week as we look a little more at the stigma and the historical basis, often going back into the 1800s and how that continues into the present. As always, I'd love to hear your feedback and hear if you have any questions that you'd like to have covered on this podcast. Until next week, go Team Fibro.